Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Matt, here we are, Thrive Deeper, our, as you like to say, a two-weekly Bible study.
That's right.
Hopefully people are getting into the Word every day through their Thrive Bible reading guide, but every couple of weeks we like to unpack the last couple of weeks of readings. And today, Matt, we're going to be picking up from Genesis chapter 16 and working our way through to the end of Genesis chapter 24. And just up front, let me say, just some weird stuff in here in terms of our modern context. And I think sometimes we have to try to put ourselves back in the time that that this was written, because there's some stuff we'll come across that we kind of go, what? Really?
Well, there are some things here that people at the time would have thought,
okay,
what?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The first story, Stu, that we're going to look at today is the story of Hagar and Ishmael. And this has given a lot of space. And Hagar, we have here the first appearance of the angel of the Lord, right? You think this is these important moments. I mean, the angel of the Lord, you know, visits the most important Bible characters. The first appearance of the angel of the Lord is to a slave girl.
From Egypt.
From Egypt. So this story would, in an ancient world context, a person would have thought, why
girl
is this memorializing? A slave
girl,
and why is God? Gods don't talk to unimportant people. In the ancient Near East, the ancient Near Eastern gods, they interact with kings and really significant people. This is the significance of this first story, and this is easy for us to miss how this was so countercultural for its time, that a slave girl would have this kind of divine attention. A validation of her humanity and value, and at a time when, you know, slave girls would not even been seen as fully human. I mean, the practice of this form of surrogacy, let's call it that, was very common thing in the culture at the time. If a woman couldn't have a child, she would get her slave, her handmaid, and the handmaid would have the child. But it would because
the mother's child,
because the handmaid's just the vessel, doesn't really count.
It's irrelevant.
Right? This person doesn't count. But for God, this person counts, right? So, I mean, everything so far in Genesis, it's culturally intelligible, but in order to be culturally contrasting, I mean, Genesis 1 is the classic example of something that absolutely is culturally intelligible symbolism, but in a way that is monumentally contrasting
to
everything else that's going on at the time. And this is the beauty of the text. It's intelligible, but it's doing something so completely different to anything that's around anywhere for hundreds of years, you know, like for 1,000 years after this. So, I mean, it's not really until the dominance of Christendom in the sort of Middle Ages that a lot of these thought patterns start to change as a result of the influence of biblical ways of thinking. But yeah, the fact that a slave should have this kind of attention.
So let me just summarize the first part of chapter 16, just because I won't read it all out. But obviously Sarai goes to Abram and says, her words, "Since the Lord has prevented me from bearing children, go to my slave. Perhaps through her I can build a family." And so Abram agrees to that. Sarai gets...
Abraham agrees to it. This doesn't mean that God does. So I think that's the point.
Well, and I mean, even Sarai saying, God has prevented me from bearing a child.
Already, the way that's put, it's patterned. There's a patterning here that makes it sound very much like, this is pointed out by commentators, like Genesis chapter 3, you know, taking the fruit, giving it. It's the same pattern. And it's not about the gender, which side of the gender does this.
Did God really
the fact
again?
Is, this is actually not the way that God wanted it to be, right? So this ancient practice of, you know, surrogacy. Is not something that God endorses here. It's just something that they come up with. We're not having a child. Let's do it the customer. You know, let's do it this way.
Yeah, and we'll see that again later in the in the story.
And the point is that, I mean, behind this, and we know this. You know, God's looking at this, saying, "No, don't help me. I don't.
That's right. I don't need your help.
We're going to do this properly. Don't do this in human ways.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it my way."
Hagar does go to Abram. She falls pregnant. But at that point in time, Sarai sort of feels like Hagar is treating her with disrespect, because now she's got Abram's child. And Abram basically says to Sarai, "Well, here's your slave. She's in your power. You do whatever you want with her, kind of thing. And Sarai, according to the passage, really mistreated her. And so Hagar ran away. And that's, as you say, when the angel of the Lord appeared and found her by a spring in the wilderness. And he said, "Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" And she replied, "I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai." The angel of the Lord said to her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her authority." The angel of the Lord said to her, "I will greatly multiply your offspring and they will be too many to count."
Yeah. So Hagar would have her time where she would be sent off.
Yes.
And, you know, God blesses her. God blesses her son, Ishmael. Yeah. This is meant to be seen as an unfortunate incident. This is not the way that it should have happened.
Yes.
And it leads to suffering. Mm. It doesn't make things better for Sarah. It's interesting that the attention of God here is on Hagar, not Sarah. It's not, the angel of the Lord doesn't appear to Sarah, but to Hagar, to ensure that Hagar knows that she's going to be blessed, that it's, you know, that God is with her. Again, remarkable.
But also because God's promise, covenant promise to Abram about his offspring.
Yeah, that's right. And covers everyone in his household. Yeah. So it fundamentally reshapes. This is the interesting thing. What you see the blessing of God doing here on Abraham and his household, because the household unit, and that includes the servants, because there's a natural kind of authority structure that kind of works here, and everyone under the umbrella of Abraham as the sort of clan leader, let's say, receives this blessing. Now, what it does is it fundamentally reshapes how everyone sees everyone else, right? So this is the thing. You see the same thing in the early church where Paul is saying, right, now you need to fundamentally reshape how you see each other, right? So masters and slaves, you're completely equal. You sit at the same table, you eat together. Men, women, slave, free, Jew, Gentile, you're all equal before God. So it fundamentally changed how the relationships were going to work within the household of blessing. Mm. And that's what you see here. So God is honoring the fact. So here is someone that's essentially being, well, cursed. Sarah is treating her as a slave, but God does not view Hagar as a mere slave.
Yeah.
She sits under this blessing. Mm. And this is the interesting thing. The first person other than Abraham that God appears to say, oh, and you too, this applies to you too, is Hagar, the slave.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
An Egyptian slave.
Yeah, that's right. And her response in verse 13, she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. Mm. You are the God who sees me. I find this so moving, Stu, because for her, she's unseen. Like, she's this unseen nobody in terms of the eyes of the world.
Yeah.
She's an unseen nobody with no rights, with no individual sense of worth, but the fact that God comes to her, that God sees her, this is remarkable for her. And that's why she responds in that way. For she said, I have now seen the one who sees me.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful moment of completely upturning the hierarchies that were so much part of ancient life.
Yeah. So then we move into chapter 17.
Mm.
And again, this kind of feeds into what you were just saying before about the whole household and God's command to Abraham in relation to the covenant, the practice of circumcision, and God looking for a way to set aside those people.
Yeah, so throughout the story, Stu, in fact, throughout Genesis, you've got these regular points where God reaffirms the same promise. So Genesis 12, 2 to 3, I always say to people, you've got to memorize that. Memorize Genesis 12, 2 to 3, because that's going to determine the whole of, well, certainly the rest of Genesis. In fact, it's, I often refer to it as a synopsis of the Bible, because that's the story of the Bible, right?
Yeah.
It's, I will make you into a great nation. That's I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing.
Yes.
Those who bless you will be blessed. Those who curse you will be cursed, and all the ends of the earth will be blessed through you.
Yeah.
So we see that promise reaffirmed. Now, added to that is the promise of land. It's interesting that it doesn't sit necessarily inside that promise. So having the land is sort of an initial kind of provisional New Eden situation where a new kind of community is going to be developed. And then there's the promise, and here the promise of kings as well. Kings will come from you, right? So the promise of a royal line. So there is some development, but the crucial core part of the promise is in those verses in Genesis 12, 2 to 3. And what's added here, and you see this development because Genesis 12 is where the promise is given. Genesis 15 is where the covenant is cut in that customary way. Yep. This is now a sign of the covenant for Abraham and Abraham's offspring. So, and this is also where his name is changed.
Yes.
From Abram to Abraham, because he's going to be the father of many nations.
Yeah. So this is where he kind of goes, it's a permanent covenant. So second half of verse 7, it's a permanent covenant to be your God and the God of your offspring after you. And to you and your future offspring, I will give the land where you are residing, all the land of Canaan as a permanent possession, and I will be their God. And then God also said to Abraham, as for you and your offspring. So
yeah, that's right.
Takes place.
And so the covenant of circumcision kind of relates to this, because this is about descendants. It's about God's promise, enduring promise to descendants.
Yes.
So the choice of Mark is, it's an interesting, because it has that sense of generation. You know, it's interesting that there's a sense in biblical worldview that our, you know, sexuality, I've often referred to as like the inner sanctum of our sacred, this temple. You know, it's a very, it's treated with great, you know, with great sacredness and care. And it's why nakedness is an issue, because generally when something is sacred, as in the temple, it's closed off, like the most holy places. Yeah. It's put a curtain behind it.
Yes.
So nakedness becomes a problem when you just kind of barge in there, or you sort of see this at different points.
Well, we saw it in Noah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, this choice of a body part for circumcision, I think, sits within that sort of, you know, that kind of thought world. But it's actually not unknown in the ancient world. It's a number of nations, including Egyptians, even some of the nations of Canaan. It wasn't known in Mesopotamia. This is according to Wenham, who writes Word Biblical Commentary. It's interesting that it is something that is known. Not Abraham hadn't practiced it in Mesopotamia,
yes. Okay.
But it is known, at the time.
So again, it's taking something like the rainbow that already existed, probably, and saying this is now going to be a sign.
You know, maybe the fact that it was known means that there was a sort of semiotic, kind of understood semiotic value to it. What I mean by that is it said something. It was a something that people understood as saying something about, you know, that person, that they, this is a person dedicated, you know, to God or something, perhaps. So we're not to imagine here like this is never, you know, this is the first time that's happened before. Perhaps God is using something here that does say something, perhaps within that cultural context. We don't really know.
No.
But it is reshaped in a biblical context, and this is the important thing. And the idea that's often used in later prophetic literature is because, you know, talks about, I think even Moses talks about circumcising your heart in Deuteronomy. So there's a sense of it refers to the, you know, the cutting away of a heart, a sort of hard-heartedness perhaps. And there's a lot of different aspects to the symbolism. But so this becomes the symbol of the covenant. And so both of their names are changed because the promise is being affirmed in this. Abraham becomes the father of multitude. Sarai becomes Sarah as well.
So just before we move past that, Matt, just because I'm conscious that there may be relatively new Christians reading this right now who read, if any male is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that man will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant.
Yeah.
How does that change after Jesus came? Just to make, you know, to give some clarity for people.
Yeah. So this in the early church, as in the Acts period church, this was an important issue of discussion. And what came out of that, and Paul is very adamant about this in his epistle to the Galatians, is that this is not something that Christians need to practice. This is something that was a mark of the covenant up until the time of Christ. And now it's baptism is essentially takes its place. Yeah. Which is why some churches practice baptism of children, because they see it as taking the place of the household covenant.
Yep.
That actually isn't how initially baptism was practiced, on profession of faith and believers. So, I mean, we know that because in the early church, there was quite a process of initiation before baptism. Infant baptism becomes a thing a little bit later. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that the practice of infant baptism doesn't have some
value.
Theological value. I say that because, yes, I know there are differences in the way that the symbol is practiced, but
it's the intent that matters the most.
We don't need to say that well, they're doing it the wrong way, yes, and we're doing it the right way. I prefer the way, yes, at adult baptism. I think I think that's preferable for me because obviously I'm a Baptist pastor.
Yeah, but we would take the infant baptism and say that's dedication in a sense. As parents, as a family, dedicating our child so that they can make that decision in the future. Yeah. In other traditions, as you say, they might do infant baptism and then they have the confirmation. At
that's right. So it's just using the same symbol in slightly different ways, and actually that's fine. I mean,
the most important thing is the intent of the heart.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
That's right.
That's the point.
And the point that we're making here is that essentially baptism takes the place of circumcision.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Now, God said to Abraham, and I like this little passage here, "As for your wife Sarai, do not call her Sarai, for Sarah will be her name. I will bless her indeed. I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she will produce nations. Kings of peoples will come from her," as you said. And Abram fell face down, and then he laughed and said to himself, "Can a child be born to a 100-year-old man? Can Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, give birth?" So Abram said to God, "If only Ishmael were acceptable to you." And then goes, "But God said, no, your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will name him Isaac. I will confirm my covenant with him as a permanent covenant for his future offspring."
It's interesting that that's Abraham's response first.
Yes, exactly. He's laughing.
He's just thinking, this is ridiculous. And the point is, he thinks it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right. We're old people. We can't, and this is the thing throughout these stories, you do see a very fallible faith.
Yes.
Abraham is a man of faith,
but
it's a fallible faith, right? And he has these moments, right, where there is a change.
There is a change, it seems to me, which we'll get into fairly soon, where it seems like something that I would feel would take an incredible amount of faith that doesn't appear to be a moment of doubt.
That's
we'll,
right.
We'll come
to
that later.
Let's move into chapter 18 because this is the chapter 18, 19. We have the messengers from God, these angelic messengers, the three angels, as it were, or messengers that come. Mm. They come and visit him. Important background for these stories is the importance of hospitality in an ancient world context, particularly in a Jewish context, welcoming particularly brothers and it was seen as enormously important sort of moral principle that you never leave someone out in the cold, to welcome them into your house and to honor them and to look after them is incredibly important thing. That's important for what we're going to come to.
Was that based on a superstition, do you think, or was that just, it was just a tradition that...
It was just a deeply embedded tradition. I'm not sure of the background to it. You do see it somewhat as a sort of ancient world thing, but particularly within Israel, this takes on a whole other dimension because the treatment of your brothers, the Cain and Abel thing and the sense, the importance of treating your brothers, it's the opposite of Cain saying, "Am I my brother's keeper?"
Yes, yes.
Well, you are responsible for looking after your brothers. And there's a strong sense of that in the community that you don't let of course these are angels, but he doesn't know that. That becomes apparent
later.
Further on. So the angels make this promise. He convinces them to stay. They make this promise. And this is, of course, when Sarah laughs as well, because she overhears this conversation, because they're saying around this time next year, you're going to have, your wife Sarah's going to have a son. And she just thinks this is...
And it's just interesting
ridiculous.
That there's that verse, this is God saying to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh saying, "Can I really have a baby when I'm old? Is anything impossible for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will come back to you, and in about a year, she will have a son." Sarah denied it. "I did not laugh," she said, because she was afraid. But he replied, "No, you did laugh."
It's a great story.
It's a great little line there.
And then, so the men go now, and there's an important moment of sort of deliberation because it says, "Then the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham?" I mean, is this who is God saying this to? Mm. This is a moment, a very important moment where we're let into a moment of divine deliberation. That's a real clue to the reader of the meaning of what's going to happen next.
Yes.
We've got a slightly strange story coming up next.
We have.
But this is the key to the meaning of it. Mm. He's going to tell Abraham what he's about to do.
Yes.
And the sense here is that Abraham is being brought into, as it were, the counsel of God, because Abraham is given the right, and we could even say the responsibility,
yes,
to actually do something here. about the circumstance. So he says, Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation. All nations of the earth will be blessed through him, right? Mm. So he's brought into this and reminded. Now, remember that bit.
Yes.
That you're going to be a blessing to the nations, right? The nations will be blessed through you, right?
Yeah.
And it talks about calling his children as well to do what is right and just. And this is actually part of this mandate, right? So it's, and then he says, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great. I'm going to go down and see if it's as great. Now, God knows.
Yes.
So that can only mean one thing for Abraham, that Sodom and Gomorrah, they're done for, really done for. And the word outcry generally applies to the same word is generally used of particularly terrible injustices.
Right.
Like cruelty and injustice, right? Mm. Now, this is saying something for the ancient world, Stu, because these are hard times.
It was already hard,
compared
to us now.
Yeah, there was a normal level of
hardness.
Of difficulty, but these guys were at a whole other level. Mm. So we don't know exactly what that was, but Abraham knows, and he knows that they're done for, right? So, and he's thinking, and one of the problems for Abraham, of course, is that Lot. His nephew lives there with his family. He's made a life there. He's probably got, you know, business and all this sort of stuff there. And so he's thinking, oh, no. So the men go towards Sodom, and it says, again, this moment of deliberation, Abraham remains standing before the Lord.
Yes.
And then he does something that's actually never happened before. This is actually going to be the first instance of intercession. Now, the intercessory role of God's people is, I mean, in Exodus 19, God says about the people of Israel that you're going to be a kingdom of priests. The Apostle Peter in his letter, first letter, says the same thing of Christians. You're a royal priesthood, right?
Yeah.
And to be a priesthood means to mediate blessing. That's what he's just said before about that through you, the nations will be blessed.
Yeah.
That's a mediatorial role. You're mediating blessing. Now, the mediatorial role is like a priestly role. Mm. And what we have here is Abraham, in a sense, taking his first steps. These are the first steps, the first time anyone has interceded in this way, appealing to who God is and what God has promised on the base that interceding for someone. Now, I mean, people in the ancient world prayed to their gods, but never with any assurance of the character of those gods. In many cases, the character of the gods is worse than any people. Certainly with no assurance, because there was never any commitment that their gods made to them. The unique thing about the one almighty creator God that is revealed here in Genesis, the unique thing about Yahweh, as his people come to know him, is that he has made this oath. He's bound himself by covenant to Abram. So Abram's now going to discover the implications of this, right? This comes with a calling and a responsibility.
Mm.
And so he's taking the first steps. And you sense it's a little bit like when, you know, when my kids started to walk, you know, you put them down and they take a few steps. You come on, keep coming. And you sense this, what's going to happen now is Abraham's going to appeal to the character of God. So he says,
what if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away instead of sparing the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people who are in it?
Yeah, far be it from you to do such a thing and so forth. And the Lord replies, if I find 50 righteous people in the city of Sodom, I will spare the whole place for their sake.
Yeah.
Now, the remarkable thing about this is that what's clear is that there's a movement toward judgment here. So essentially, this stops the hand of judgment. And let's just put away, does God change his mind?
Yeah.
There's a sort of a kind of mutualism being worked out here. I think asking abstract questions like that, okay, God doesn't change. Mm. But somehow it still works that there's this genuine relational interaction where God invites us, as it were, into his counsel and responds to our prayers in such a way that our prayers make a difference. Now, the reason our prayers make a difference goes back to the original mandate,
that's right,
where we are put in charge of the earth.
Yeah.
So if we want something to change here,
it has to happen through us.
Then it happens through prayer, right? Mm. So this is a function of our God-given authority.
Mm.
Now, God is calling Abram to step back up into that Adamic, that kind of authority that he originally called human beings to walk in. So this is what's happening here. But Abraham, he's never done this before, right?
Yeah.
So he's quite timid about this. Mm. And what you see through this, there's six times he works down, first of all, in fives. But notice how sort of tenuous he is.
Yes. It's almost like the first time he's kind of surprised.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. All right. Well, how about I try 45 next?
Yeah, that's right. And but notice what he says. Now that I've been so bold as to speak to the Lord, though I'm nothing but dust and ashes. I mean, it's pretty. He's pretty surprised at what's happening here, even though this is implicit in what God has promised. Mm. You know, what if the number is 5 less than 50 and then God answers and then he goes to 5 less than 45, right? Mm. He goes to 40. And then he gets a little bolder because then he starts going down by tens, right? Starts going down by fives and then, and I know it feels like negotiation, but it's not negotiation.
No, that's right.
This is Abraham finding out inductively the possibilities here.
Right. And the power of his intercession to God.
Yeah. So in verse 30, you know, may the Lord not be angry, but let me speak. Now, behind this, God is delighted at what Abraham, this is his calling, right? So quite the opposite. God's not angry, but he doesn't know that, right? He just feels like he's pushing it a little bit. But we know, of course, that this is what God loves. This is what God wants. This is what faith looks like. It's part of Abraham's faith.
Yeah.
So he goes and, you know, again, in verse 31, now that I've been bold as to speak to the Lord, you know, he finally gets down to 10 and he stops at 10. Now, could he have gone down to 1? There's some interesting ideas behind this because there is this, you know, this idea. And of course, ultimately, God saves the whole world for the sake of the righteousness of one in Christ. Okay. Yeah. So ultimately, Abraham's prayer is answered ultimately in Christ. Now, there are not even 10 righteous people in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm. So the cities are destroyed, but God still answers his concern. His concern is for Lot. Mm. And actually, as we'll see, it goes on, God remembered Abraham and he spares Lot and the town in that region. So that there is a town called
Zoar.
Yeah, Zoar that he goes to. And God spares that town for the sake of Lot and his two daughters. Mm. So there are three righteous people that go to one of the towns in the region and that town is saved because of them. So the prayer is, it's not exactly how Abraham, but this is, I think, an important point as well, because in the end, God is faithful. He answers the concern even more, actually, for the sake of three righteous people. The town of Zoar is saved. Lot is saved. That's the point here. But ultimately, actually, there's something even greater that comes out of this. So it's interesting, Stu, too, in order to form a synagogue amongst Jewish people, it has to start with 10 righteous men.
There you go.
To form a synagogue in a city.
Oh, right.
You can't form a synagogue unless you have 10 righteous. And that comes from this.
So, there we go. You've kind of given away somewhat of the story.
I have. So,
we need to move through anyway. So that's
So the angels come to the city of Sodom, and Lot, of course, insists that they come into. They know we're not going.
Here's
to
the hospitality thing again.
And this is the hospitality. He insists, right? Now, again, let me just say how important this is, because one of the things about this rule of hospitality is that when someone comes under your roof, you are morally responsible for everything that happens to them.
Right.
So there's a sense of moral responsibility for everyone under your roof. Right. That actually answers a lot of of other things too. But so then this is where we have this terrible story, Stu, about all of the people of the city then come out. Now, notice what it says in verse 4, Stu. All the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old. Why is it so emphatic about this, do you think?
Well, it's trying to make sure that everyone knows there was no more than 10.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Everyone.
Yeah, because everyone is involved in this.
The whole population surrounded the house.
Yeah, that's right. So they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them.
Yeah.
In the Hebrew, it's so that we can know them, and that can mean a few different things, but it becomes very evident that because Lot offers his daughters, now we'll talk about that in a moment, in their place.
Yeah.
So it's very evident in the context that that's what it's actually talking about.
And even in the previous text with Hagar and...
Yeah, to know is a polite way of talking about sexual intimacy. That's right. So it says that Lot goes outside to meet them. He says, don't do this wicked thing. And so verse 8, this is the difficult. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man.
Let me bring
them out. You can do whatever you want. Now, goodness me. I mean,
and this is a righteous man.
Yeah. I mean, so remember, he is responsible for everyone at his roof, including his daughters. Mm. So he's willing to sacrifice his daughters in order to protect these men. Now, is this the right thing? We don't need to see that this is the right thing, right? These stories in Genesis aren't about people doing the right thing. No. And when we get to the Jacob stories, that's going to be particularly important to understand, right? Because we're not looking at these characters saying, oh, we should do what these characters do. I mean, is this a shame? Because this is on a shame culture as well. Mm. And so is there a sense of these three men have come under his roof? Yes. He needs to protect them at all costs, in a sense. Is this him protecting his honor? Or is he just figuring out what is the best or worst thing to do here? Mm. I think he feels like this is a noble sacrifice, in a sense.
Yeah.
In the end, that doesn't happen.
Because they
refuse this. The angels pull him inside the house. The angels, of course, are going to have none of that as well.
No,
notice that part, right?
Yes.
They strike the men of the city with blindness. They said, right, get out of the city. Let's go.
It's
right,
over.
Everyone go.
Yeah.
Strict instructions. Leave the city. Don't look back. So they leave the city. Of course, famously, Lot's wife. Looks back. Now, the text is very minimal. We don't know what exactly. I mean, I think there's a hesitation. You know, they're leaving a lot behind. Mm. I think she's struggling. You know, maybe she's struggling with it. We don't know what is involved in that looking back. But she gets whatever the conflagration that happens. You know, I mean,
hits
there's burning sulfur and there's lots of speculation, stew over what happens because there's all these tar pits there and is there essentially an earthquake and it gets and the gases ignite and the point is God does this, right? I don't think it's necessary to look for natural explanations. I think there could be, but the text I think is emphasizing that this is a disaster from the Lord, that these and this symbol of fire is this symbol of purging and judgment. I think that's an important part of this too. So it says,
run for your lives, don't look back and don't stop anywhere. And then Lot.
So she looks back and it says she became a pillar of salt. Now that's very minimal. Like again, because remember that my illustration with the dots, like events being like lots of dots and text just choose certain dots. Mm. So does she get hit by this in her
delay,
hesitation, or delay? Mm. Does she get struck down by this? The area is an area of salt. Does her body, this is not, it's not like suddenly she turns into salt, we're in a Narnia novel or something like that you know.
It
could have been, but that's not necessary.
But it's not important either. Yeah. The point here is that having been commanded to leave straight away for whatever reason, and the look back, as you said, and I think it's a good point, it doesn't necessarily mean she just looked over her shoulder. It probably means more like she went back to get something that was important to her, or she couldn't leave for whatever reason.
That's right.
And this is what happened in the end. So
But
then Lot asks a favor. He doesn't want to have to run to the mountains. We're not really sure why.
Yeah.
But he asks if they could let him go to a town that's nearby. And so they agree and take him to the town called Zoar.
And that town is saved because they're there.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, as we move on, it says in verse 30 that Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains. So they end up going to the mountains anyway. And I think this is a bit of a lapse of faith because God had said, I'll protect you in Zoar. I mean, Lot, unfortunately, even though he sits under God's promise, it's a sad sort of ending because he ends up living in a cave.
Yeah.
He leaves this place where God had said, I will protect you.
Mm. But possibly because other people had relatives that were in Sodom and Gomorrah, they thought maybe Lot was responsible. We don't know, but you're right. The point here is that he didn't trust God for his safety.
Yeah, and I think in the text that's the thing that we're meant to see, that it says because he was afraid to stay in Zoar, right? Mm. Now, God had said that he was going to bless him and that, I mean, he's under this promise, but he just can't accept this. So
then we get another strange, in our context anyway, I'm not sure if this was a common thing. They're living in a cave. There were no sons because he only had daughters. They wanted to make sure that Lot's line continued.
Yeah.
And so the firstborn daughter says to the younger, our father is old and there is no man in the land to sleep with us, as is the custom of all the land. Let's get our father to drink wine so that we can sleep with him and preserve our father's line.
Mm. Mm. again, this doesn't say that that was the right thing to do. And it echoes, of course.
Taking things into their own hands again.
They're taking things into their own hands. And just to underscore the fact that this is not really the right thing, it has this echo of the Noah story. Mm. It's actually worse in a sense. And of course, incest is, as we find out later, is not something that God approves of. So they're not doing the right thing here.
Yeah.
They're taking things into their own hands. This is a theme that we've seen throughout these stories. That's important to note here, that part of what's happening in these stories is that we're seeing God's faithfulness, but we also see the lapses of faith in people by contrast, right?
Yes.
You don't need to do this because God will provide for you, right? But they're just not believing in that.
Yeah.
And of course, it's from this that the Moabites and the Ammonites come from that.
That's right.
That relationship.
They were the fathers of those nations. Yep.
So we come to an interesting story, Stu, in the way that it echoes chapter 12, the last part of chapter 12. You recall in chapter 12, Abraham has this, he goes down to Egypt. And he has this moment of fear where he lies about his wife, says, she's my sister, because he's afraid that he'll be killed so that Pharaoh can take his wife. And he didn't need to do that because God had said he would protect him. Now, this happens actually again here. And so we have this lapse of faith.
He lies to Abimelech, who is the king of Gerar.
And he's a God-fearing king as well, He's not like the people of Sodom, and we've had that story. So he's not actually like them. This is not a nation full of wicked people. This is actually a nation with a relatively God-fearing king.
Yes. Who prays, clearly. He speaks to God, because in verse 4 it says, now Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, Lord, would you destroy a nation even though it is innocent?
Yeah.
Didn't Abraham himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. I did this with a clear conscience and clean hands.
Yeah. So we have here, it's the same thing happens again. The important thing here, I think, is the difference, Stu. The difference here is in what has to happen for that curse to be lifted.
Yes.
So in the first story, as soon as Pharaoh gave Sarah back to Abraham, the curse lifts, right? It's an automatic thing. But here it's different, because in order for the curse to lift, what does he say?
He says to Abraham, you have to forgive him. You have to pray for him.
And I think that's important, because he says to Abimelech, now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. Now, this is important after chapter 18, of course, because Abraham's just learnt about intercessory prayer, right? So this is where the change in pattern, because there's been a development now, right? Mm. So now, in order to lift the curse, Abraham has to pray for Abimelech, even though you'd think, shouldn't it just automatically? But see, that's not in the purpose of God. It's not just an automatic thing. It's through the prayers of his people that the curse is lifted. Yeah. And this is the way it's going to work from now on. This is really important setup here for the priestly ministry of Israel, which itself is going to be a symbol of the ministry under the New Covenant Church, which we are part of.
Yeah, totally.
So finally, Stu.
Sarah becomes pregnant.
And we have the story of the birth of Isaac. So we see God is faithful. And this is so much of these stories. This is about God. This is a book about God, ultimately. And
we're constantly seeing the failure of man, even great men, as we would say in Abraham, yet God's constant faithfulness
to
fulfill his promises.
And as we've said, even to Hagar, the slave woman, who makes another appearance in this story. Such an interesting character, the attention that Hagar has given, because we see that when Isaac is weaned and being this could be, up to sort of 3 years of age, Sarah notices that in some context that
Ishmael
is having a bit of a go at Isaac. And we don't really know what's happening here. And maybe Sarah's a little sensitive about this. There were laws in the ancient world whereby a son of a slave girl could actually inherit alongside the son of the legitimate wife.
Yeah. And remember, he was the firstborn. Of Abraham.
Yeah, that's right. So he was the firstborn of Abraham. So that, there's a sense here in which he looks like he's taking that role of the firstborn, that he thinks that he's still the firstborn, perhaps. Is there a threat? Does Sarah feel like, hang on, is he going to share in the inheritance with my son?
Yeah.
But yeah, we don't know what's going on here. So she just demands, you've got to get rid of the slave girl. And again, this is not necessarily the right thing to do. It's not like Sarah's doing the right thing here. But Abraham, it says, God said to him, do not be so distressed about the boy and your slave woman. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the slave into a nation also, because he is your offspring. So God's saying, it's okay, Abraham, because Abraham's faced with a difficult circumstance here. How is this going to work? And God says, look, absolutely, it is actually through Isaac. Mm. Now, this is important to you, I think, at this point to say that at each point, with each generation, there's this sense of God choosing which of the patriarchs is going to carry the particular promise through.
Yes.
So it's Isaac first, then it's Jacob is the next one, not Esau, because there are two brothers there. Yep, so it's Jacob, not Esau. And then you've got the 12 tribes of Israel, and they all carry the promise, the 12 tribes of Israel. But for now, you've got this sense that God is identifying which of the brothers it's going to go
through. Is what
and Isaac is the one here.
Whatever Sarah says to you, listen to her, because your offspring will be traced through Isaac. Yeah. And I will also make a nation of the slave son, because he is your offspring as well.
Yeah. So God has made a promise about Ishmael.
Yes.
And the text is always... He wants to show that wherever God makes a promise, that will never be the end of the story. You're not just not going to hear from that. There's always going to be a sign that God is faithful to that promise. Yeah. So when, you know, Hagar goes away and she's out in the desert and she's, I mean, this is very difficult, right? She's a slave woman. She's always lived in this household. This feels like exile again. She's, you know. By the way, Ishmael is older, so he's not, so...
It's not a boy and a 12-year-old. Yeah.
So things like when, because it says early the next morning, Abraham took some food and skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He set them on her shoulders and sent her off with the boy. The boy isn't on her shoulders. It's the all of this other stuff that's on her shoulders. When she puts the boy under the bushes because he's wasting away. I mean, they've run out of water. Yeah. They've obviously gotten lost in the desert, and she despairs. She puts the boy under a tree. He's young teenager boy probably, or something, and he's crying.
Well, she's crying for him.
Yeah, that's right. Because it says God heard the boy crying.
Yes.
You know, so here we see God's fulfillment. God, again, the attention that's given to Hagar, to Ishmael, again, beautiful reminder of God's faithfulness to those who are otherwise invisible, and God's faithfulness to his promise to Ishmael. So God opens her eyes. She sees a well of water. And then we're told that, you know, the boy grows up and his mother finds a wife from Egypt. And so he becomes a nation. That's whether that nation goes well, another question.
Yes. And from my research, it seems that there wasn't really much in the way of genealogical records kept in relation to Ishmael, but it's probably considered, compared to the Israelites anyway, it's probably considered that he's the father of the Arab, a number of the Arab nations.
Yeah, that's right. We have a story then about a treaty that Abraham makes with Abimelech. So we've met Abimelech before. This is important because Abraham is doing things the right way. I mean, he's doing the right thing by Abimelech. They make an agreement about the well at Beersheba.
Yeah.
Then, Stu, let's turn to 22 because I think there's a bit of discussion needed about this one. So we come now to a very famous story. I would say, Stu.
Famous and important.
Famous and important, and actually, you know, one of the most well-known stories in the Bible and considered to be probably one of the most profound stories in the Bible. This has been written about so much, this story. It's horrifying in the sense that, of course, the great issue that this sets up is that Abraham is asked, God asks him, we don't know how, but Abraham is very clear that this is God saying to him, verse 2, God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love. It's stressing. Of course, there's Ishmael, but Ishmael's gone now.
Yes.
Okay, so this is his only, it's like God saying, this is your only hope. I want you to take your only hope, your only son, and
go to the
region of Moriah, right? So this is about 3-day journey from where Abraham is. Why Moriah? This is eventually where the temple, this is the mountain where the temple is going to be built, where the temple sacrifices. Yes. On that mountain, that's where God will provide, symbolically provide
the sacrificial lamb.
You know, the sacrificial lamb. so that God's people might have favor. It's also the same mountain on which Jesus is crucified, sort of a stone's throw, same general area. So that's why that's important. And it says, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on the mountain, I will show you. Now, look, for Stu, for an ancient Jewish reader, this is equally shocking as it is to us. Because God abhors child sacrifice.
Although it was common at the time.
It was common at the time. So in one sense for Abraham, he's in a thought world where this is not unknown. This is a known thing. And we've got to remember here, see, Abraham's still learning. He's learning about how this works inductively.
Yes.
Now, in the ancient world, the idea is that human beings were created to provide food for the gods, as it were. So sacrifices were seen as food for the gods, right?
Yep.
And if you offered lots of sacrifice, you would appease the gods and you would win their favor. Now, if you really wanted to win
the
ultimate sacrifice that you could make to win the favor of the gods was, of course, child sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Now, we see an echo of this in the book of Judges, Jephthah, the story of Jephthah, where Jephthah promises and he does a bit of bargaining. And again, not something that he should have done, but he makes this vow. God, if you help me, he tries to bargain with God, which you don't need to do. But he, treats God like a pagan God. Says, if you help me, I will sacrifice the first thing that comes out the door to greet me. Now, I think he knows full well. Leaves ambiguity there, but he knows full well this could be his daughter. You know, we have an inkling of that way of thinking in Jephthah there. It's not something that God wanted.
No.
Now, actually, this story, part of what this story is doing, very much a part of this story, that it's saying, you never have to do that sort of thing.
Yes.
In the context of saying, you don't provide for me, Abraham, I provide for you. So what this story is doing in a really important and very dramatic and very difficult for Abraham, but we've got to remember that Abraham has this prophetic role. We've already been told Abraham is a prophet in the story about Abimelech.
Yes.
He's a prophet. Now, prophets not only spoke the truth, they embody the truth. So Abraham is not a prophet in the sense that he's delivering prophetic oracles. He's a prophet in the sense that his life is modeling something, that God is going to show things. He's a sign in a sense. So Abraham is being asked, just like Hosea, when Hosea was told to marry an adulterous woman, and, very difficult thing. Ezekiel was asked to do, was told to live on a famine diet for a year, So God often asks prophets to do quite difficult things.
To demonstrate
something. Abraham doesn't know this. We know this because we know Abraham's role. But this is what's remarkable about this. And Abraham has grown in faith
Clearly.
Up to this point.
Clearly.
And now you have the ultimate test.
There's a child he's waited 100 years for, who's the only son that he has to fulfill that promise that God's made. And now God's saying, take him to a mountain and offer him as a burnt sacrifice.
That's right.
Yeah. And yet Abraham, you don't see any. So Abraham got up early in the morning, saddled his donkey and took with him two of his young men and his son Isaac.
He just
gets on with it.
And we're told that this is a test. We're told in verse 1 that God tested Abraham. Now, this is not because God doubted his faith. God tests faith to make something manifest, right? It's to bring it forth. Now, this is still a stretch for Abraham, right? There's a sense of testing in which it also grows our faith. So there's no doubt. We're not saying that was easy for Abraham.
No.
We're just saying that he would have been incredibly difficult, in fact. I mean, he has a 3-day journey. Imagine what he's thinking on this journey.
Yeah.
Now, the writer of Hebrews tells us that Abraham probably reasoned that he would have received Isaac back from the dead. Either way, he knows that Isaac's the one
who's going to carry the line.
So he has to believe that he's going to receive Isaac back. That's the reasoning of the writer of Hebrews, that he believed that he would receive Isaac back from death. And in a sense, he did receive him back from the dead, right?
Yes.
But only because God provided a lamb.
Yeah.
Now, again, to stress, this is part of this story is saying you don't ever have to do this. But here's why, right? Mm. Because I provide for you, you don't provide for me. Now, it's still a hard lesson. So they make this 3-day journey. Isaac wonders, where's the lamb?
There's just one passage before, one little bit before that I thought. So when they get to the base of the mountain, Abraham says to the other young men, you stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there to worship and then we'll come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac.
Yeah.
Where have we seen someone carry the wood for their own sacrifice.
Yeah, that's right.
Before it's pointing forward to.
Yeah, ultimately, this story again, it shows how God provided for us, and God, you know, the same. You know, John 3:6 famously, you know, for God so loved the world that He gave His one and only, you know, or His only begotten Son. Same sort of language John is using as this. Okay, so that's the fulfillment.
Hopefully, I didn't steal your thunder, but
no. So Isaac is wondering, Father, where's
the lamb? We've got the knife, we've got everything ready to go, but
this is where Abraham plays a very explicitly prophetic role here, because he says something that is prophetic. Abraham answered, God Himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. Mm. That is a profoundly important prophetic statement that Abraham makes. Despite whatever he's feeling, he just believes.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how this is going to work out, but he believes.
He's got to that point where he believes.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine the difficulty of that belief, Stu?
Yeah, totally.
I don't think that there's ever been any greater test of faith than this for a human being, ever. And so this is this supreme moment. It's in that moment that he makes this prophetic declaration. So Abraham builds the altar. He takes the knife to slay his son, but the angel of the Lord cries out from heaven, Abraham, I love the way, you know, here I am, he replied. And he said that actually initially right at the beginning of the story.
Yes, he did.
When it says sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he says. Yeah. So there's this sense of presenting yourself before the Lord. He is given to God, completely given to God. There's this availability of Abraham. Do not lay a hand on the boy. He said, do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld your son, your only son. Abraham looked up there in the thicket. He saw a ram caught by its horns, and he went over and sacrificed the ram instead.
Yeah.
So Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. I mean, it's interesting editorial comment, by the way, there. To this day,
yes,
it is said,
yes,
on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. You know, we know that there are editorial work that happens well after the event. Mm. This was, you know, probably put together around the time of Moses, but we're not discounting editorial work after that as well. It's interesting. After that, in verse 15, Stu, the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time. Important moments of repeated communication here, right? I swear by myself.
Yeah.
I mean, that is an incredible statement. I mean, other instances of divine oaths occur in Genesis. This is the only instance in which the oath is introduced by the Lord Yahweh swearing himself. By himself.
Yeah.
And in that context, I swear by my, like there is a,
it's you hard can't to get
even,
a, yeah,
yeah, hard to even express how this, the emphasis of this moment because of the faith. And it's the faith of Abraham here that God is responding to.
Totally.
You know, Abraham's not earning this. There's no sense of earning this favor because the promise is declared again. He's already made the promise.
Mm.
Just lest we think that he earns this promise, it's reiterated. I will surely bless you, make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possessions of the cities of the enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. So this is the development. Essentially, this preempts the development that we get in Exodus, because in Exodus 19, what God says to his people through Moses is that I'm calling you to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Yep. Now, in order to be a kingdom of priests, you have to be a holy nation. You have to be separate, right? You have to walk in my blessing to be able to mediate that blessing, right? So you need to obey me. It's not, you don't earn the blessing by obeying, but in order to fulfill this role, you have to obey. You have to walk in blessing in order to mediate blessing. So that's why this is added here, and it preempts that development. So you see there's a sort of, the plan is gradually developing here.
Yeah, yeah. Such a profound section here, that whole story of Abraham. And I'm interested, you know, the context of God testing and in a sense Jesus being tested as well after he was baptized, the whole test. You know, of course, we know Jesus was God incarnate, but again, the same pattern here.
Yeah, but the testing, again, that underscores the point that when it says God tested Abraham. It's not because God was in doubt about his faith. No, because God knew his faith with, and it was making it manifest.
Yes.
And this is, in the same sense, Christ was tested because it made manifest his obedience.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get the same thing happening there. So that really becomes the climax of the story of Abraham. The story of Abraham concludes with the death of Sarah and Abraham providing for Sarah's burial.
Yes.
Where he insists on purchasing the land. His neighbors want to give him land, but he insists on purchasing it. Mm. That's important because along with the well in Beersheba, this is another instance now where he has, even by human standards, some ownership. So the family of Abraham have ownership of land there. So there's already this is like the first kind of plot that is rightfully theirs in a sense. So that's, again, this purchase of the land and the insistence, no, I'm going to purchase this. I'm going to do this the right way is, you know, preempts, of course, the fulfillment of the promise that God is giving his people, the land. So overall, Stu, and in the next episode in a couple of weeks, we're going, of course, look at the amazing story of Jacob. Can I just say I'm so looking forward to that because I've been so moved by the story of Jacob again and so really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
But I think let's just sum up a takeaway from the story of Abraham, because the magnificent thing about Abraham is that while his faith is growing, we see God's faithfulness at every point, you know, faithful to Abraham, faithful to everyone in his household, to the servant girl, to Ishmael. This is a God who blesses. This is a God who sees. He sees you're not unimportant. If this is a God who sees and blesses Hagar, this is a God who sees and blesses you. This is a God who sees and blesses you, even if your faith is weak and stumbling. If we trust in Christ, he will bless us. Even if our faith is weak, however weak it is, give God a little finger and he will take that and he will draw you into greater faith. But in the meantime, you walk under the blessing of God through Jesus Christ.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.